You're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Paul Muldoon, the poetry editor of the magazine, and it's a pleasure to have you here today. As you may know, on this program, we invite a poet to choose a poem from the New Yorker archive. He or she reads it, we talk about it, then we ask them to read one of their own poems that we've published in the magazine. And I'm delighted to say that my guest today is Jonathan Galassi, a poet and also the president and publisher of Farr, Straus & Giroux, which I'm at full disclosure, he is my own publisher and he's my editor. He's among his many honours, he's been the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship. Welcome, Jonathan Galassi.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you here.
So the poem you've chosen to read is by Frederick Seidel, or Fred Seidel, Poem by the Bridge at Ten Shin. Poem by the Bridge at Ten Shin. What drew you to that?
What drew me to it is the ambition of it. Fred is a good friend of mine, and he's one of our poets at FSG. And he is someone who's very assiduously stands apart from most of what's going on in poetry today. And I think that that stance has stood him in good stead. He's written some of the really great poetry of our time. He is unapologetically looks backward in certain ways. He affects a posture that is a kind of persona that he has created in his poems that is quite confrontational in many ways, and which I think is very effective.
His middle initials are not Fred P.C. Seidel.
Not at all. Absolutely not. They might be Fred F.U. Seidel.
Well, of course, you know, poets that are, I think, meant to be provocative. I mean, I do think that's one of the things that poetry is attempting. I think on balance, it's meant to be provocative rather than soothing. At least that's the poetry that interests me. And Frederick Seidel, I think, certainly falls into that category.
Yes, provocation is certainly one of the great strains of the poetic tradition. I think I'm sitting with a poet who's quite provocative in his own ways.
Well, you know, as I say, we try. Now, Frederick Seidel is, as you say, a master of the one of the things he's a master of is the technical, the large form, the received form, the big stanza.
Yes, this poem is written in 14-line stanzas, which have a kind of a sonetic subtext. The title is lifted from Ezra Pound's Cathay. Ezra Pound himself was doing a pastiche of Li Po when he wrote a poem by the Bridge at Ten Shin. Mm. Li Po's poem is really about change, about how the present is not like the past, about what's been lost. And of course, that's probably at least two or three on the themes of most poetry. Fred has adapted that and used it to his own autobiographical and political purposes in this poem, which I think is quite a masterpiece, actually.
Now, to what extent, I mean, all poetry is autobiographical, I suppose, even when the poet is writing through a persona. Though, of course, we have to remember the other side of that is that the persona is actually to the fore always. Now, is this poem truly, quote-unquote, autobiographical, would you say?
Well, it looks back at his career in a certain way, at aspects of his life. But the points of contact that he chooses to talk about or to write about are symbolic. So I would say most poetry, yes, starts from some sort of autobiographical impulse because that's the material that the poet has to work with. But it's always torqued by whatever the other motives that the poet is operating with when he's writing the poem.
One of the things I really love about this poem, and we'll hear you read it in a moment, is the opening. This jungle poem is going to be my last. And one of the last things a poet wants to think about, I'd imagine, is that this poem is going to be his or their last.
Yes, I mean, I think there's an irony in that, of course, because it's not his last poem, but that statement, that claim, is part of the insolence and also the sense of loss that underlies it. I think that in Seidel, as in many poets, it's always two sides of a coin that you're being exposed to: the insolence, the défi, as they'd say, the defiance against a reality that isn't necessarily friendly, and also the sense that something is passing, something is gone. So the sense of lastness is there. He declares it right at the beginning.
Well, just before we go into the poem, there are a couple of words that we should really gloss, because I was not familiar with them. One is minuterie, which I think is a reference to...
In a French apartment house, when you come in, it's dark, and you have to turn a little dial, which allows you to the light to go on, so you can get to the elevator before it goes out.
It probably refers to the number of minutes one has between that light going on and the light going out. So dos caballeros, or two boys, I guess, or two horsemen. And the putti, the little angels or cherubim, the putti pacing out the hotel window. But in any case, so provocatively, let's hear the poem read by yourself, Jonathan Galassi. It's Poem by the Bridge at Ten Shin by Frederick Seidel.
This jungle poem is going to be my last. This spacewalk is. Racing in a cab through springtime Central Park, I kept my nose outside the window like a dog. The stars above my bed at night are vast. I think it is uncool to call young women Ms. My darling is a platform I see stars from in the dark, and all the dogs begin to bark. My grunting gun brings down her charging warthog, and she is frying on white water, clinging to a log, and all the foam and fevers shiver. And drink has made chopped liver of my liver. Between my legs, it's Baudelaire. He wrote about her Central Park of hair. I look for the minuterie as if I were in France, in darkness, in the downstairs entrance, looking for the light. I'm on a timer that will give me time to see the way and up the stairs before the lights go out. The so delicious Busby Berkeley dancers dance a movie musical extravaganza on the staircase with me every night. Such fun. We dance, we climb, we slip in slime, we're squirting squeezes like a wedge of lime. It's like a shout. It's what minuterie is all about. Just getting to the landing through the dark that has been interrupted for a minute is a lark. And she's so happy, it is grand. I put my mobile in her ampersand. The fireworks are a fleeting puff of sadness. The flowers, when they reach the stars, are tears. I don't remember poems I write. I turn around and they are gone. I do remember poor King Richard Nixon's madness. Pierre Laval, we loved those years. We knocked back shots of single malt all night. Beer chasers gave dos caballeros double vision, second sight. Twin putti pissing out the hotel window on the Scottish dawn. A crocodile has fallen for a fawn. I live flap copy for a children's book. He wants to lick, he wants to look. A tiny goldfinch is his cupid. Love of country makes men stupid. It makes men miss Saddam Hussein. Democracy in Baghdad makes men think monstrosity was not so bad. I followed Gandhi barefoot to remind me there is something else till it began to rain. The hurricane undressing of democracy in Baghdad starts to sink the shrunken page size of the New York Times. And yet we had a newspaper that mattered once, and that is sad. But that was when it mattered. Do I matter? That is true. I don't matter, but I do. I lust for fame, and after never finding it, I never was the same. I roar into the heavens, and I soared, and landed where I started, on a flexing diving board. I knew a beauty named Dawn Green. I used to wake at the crack of dawn. I wish I were about to land on Plymouth Rock and had a chance to do it all again, but do it right. It was green dawn in pre-America. I mean, great scented forests all along the shore, which now are gone. I've had advantages in life, and I pronounce Iraq, Iraq. The right schools taught me how to talk. I'm talking Turkey to the Kurds, but with no end in sight. These peace talks are my last. Goodbye, Iran. Iran, good night. They burned the undergrowth so they could see the game they hunt. That made the forest a cathedral clear as crystal, like a cunt. Their arrows entered red meat in the glory, streaming down from the clerestory. Karine Rueff, I was obsessed. I was possessed. I liked your name. I liked the fact Marie-Christine Karine Rueff was Jewish. It emphasized your elegance in Paris and in Florence. You were so blonde in Rue de l'Université. The dazzling daughter of de Gaulle's advisor, Jacques Rueff, was game for anything. I'm lolling here in Mayfair, under bluish clouds above a bench in Mount Street Gardens, thinking torrents. Purdy used to make a gun for shooting elephants. One cannot be the way one was back then, today. It went away. I go from Claridge's to Brands Hatch Racing Circuit and come back to Claridge's and out and eat and drink and bed and fade to black. The elephants were old enough to die but were aghast. The stars above this jungle poem are vast. To 92nd Street and Broadway I have come. Outside the windows is New York. I came here from St. Louis in a covered wagon overland behind the matchless prancing pair of Eliot and Ezra Pound. And countless moist oases took me in along the way, and some I still remember when I lift my knife and fork. The earth keeps turning, night and day, spit roasting, all the tan, tired icebergs and the polar bears, which makes white almost contraband. The biosphere on a rotisserie emits a certain sound that tells the stars that Earth was moaning pleasure while it drowned. The amorous white icebergs flash their brown teeth, hissing. They're watching old porn videos of melting icebergs, pissing. The icebergs still in pantyhose are lesbians and kissing. The rotting ocean swallows the bombed airliner that's missing.
What a remarkable poem. I mean, apart from anything else, it turns out to certainly concentrate at the end on the fate of the planet, a rather large topic and a rather pressing topic, which I think we're all going to have to readdress in the coming years, particularly the next four.
It certainly gives another meaning to the first line of the poem. This jungle poem is going to be my last. Why is it going to be his last? There's some things to think about there.
Well, the jungle is disappearing. That's part of it, of course, isn't it?
The jungle is disappearing, and so is the planet, in a way. What I love about this poem, I love many things, but one of the things I love is how he uses rhyme in a kind of insolent way. There's a kind of conventional rhyming in the poem, and then there's a kind of nursery rhyming, and there's a kind of obsessional, hysterical rhyming. The poem rises and rises to this kind of sense of of crisis.
Well, indeed, there's something desperate in at least a couple of senses about the very end. Hissing, pissing, kissing, missing. It's the kind of thing we were told not to do when we were kids in the poetry school.
Exactly, and that's why he's doing it. Being a bad boy is part of the persona that Fred uses in his poems. And there's a kind of insistence, a kind of violence to that that's very powerful, I think.
In a strange way, although there's a reference in the title to Ezra Pound, as you mentioned, Eliot and Ezra Pound are not necessarily the obvious pair of the prancing pair of horses or oxen, I suppose, that might be drawing or dragging the wagon overland. They're not necessarily the poets who lie behind this poem.
I think Seidel sees himself as a kind of latter-day extension of the modernist experiment, which is, you know, the whole thing about the overland wagon is it's going backwards. It's not, instead of going west, it's coming back east, which is, of course, what Eliot, who was also from St. Louis, did. And there's that kind of, again, ironic overlay to that. And Pound was someone who was very important to Fred as a young poet. And Eliot and Pound, of course, themselves were the prancing pair of caballeros who made modernism happen.
For some reason, as I was listening to you read this, the name Rochester came to me, the Earl of Rochester. Uh-huh. I mean, I think his, again, to use that word, provocative, outrageous poetry, sexual, what would one say, grotesqueries in many cases, I think it may lie behind this also. But who else? What about the technical aspect of it? I mean, he is able to manage a stanza in a way that I think is reminiscent of Yeats, perhaps Philip Larkin. Very few people can actually pull this off.
And what is it you're seeing, Paul, when you, in these stanzas? Do you feel that each one is a construction unto itself?
Well, I'm talking about just the way in which he's able to manage quite a complex stanzaic shape with such apparent ease. And very few people, I think, in the 20th century certainly have been able to do this. Yeats is one of the few, and Larkin another. I'm not even sure in the American tradition who might lie behind Seidel.
I think Lowell is a very important master for Seidel. And he could certainly do that.
He certainly could.
Yeah. And I would say that you could see the insolent torquing of Seidel as a kind of reworking of Lowellian grandiloquence in a kind of different key.
You know, that's a very useful way of thinking about him. It really is. Jonathan Gillespie, thank you very much indeed for that. And now we'd love to hear your own poem, which just happens to be entitled Lunch Poem for F.S.
Yes, I thought that I would have a little coda to Fred's poem by reading a poem that I wrote about a lunch that I had with Fred. Lunch poems, of course, are a great New York tradition. The originator of the lunch poem, of course, was Frank O'Hara, who didn't so much write about lunch as write at lunch. And he, I think, is the ultimate New York poet about New York. And his lunch poems have a kind of effervescence and a sense of sexiness and joy and unabashed love of our city that make them classic.
And of course, as an editor, I hope you don't mind my saying, one of your chores, I suppose, is to have the odd lunch.
Yes, and that's my ironic twist here on the lunch poem, because my poem, this poem is not written at lunch, it's written about lunch and about the ritual of lunch, which is the author and the editor having lunch together. It's another New York tradition. And this poem is about it fits into the Où sont les neiges d'antan tradition of Fred's poem, too, because it's about a restaurant that doesn't exist anymore, Montrachet, which was down in Soho and only served lunch on Fridays. It was an art world restaurant. It was a great restaurant, and it was a it specialized in Burgundian food and Burgundy wines, and it was quite the gourmet locale. And it was great fun to go down there on Friday and sort of pretend that the rest of the world didn't exist. And that's what this poem is about.
Now, one of the things I really like about this poem is that you do a little of throwing of Fred's voice. I mean, there's a line here, natter on about the that passes for Shinola, which, of course, might well come from a Fred's poem.
Well, yes, it's certainly, it's about a type of conversation that went on or goes on between the two of us. There's a jocular quality, and there is a kind of ventriloquizing in the poem.
And Shinola.
Shinola, we say. Shinola is shoe polish.
Ah.
And it's, if you don't know from Shinola, that's an American phrase.
Of course it is. But, well, there's another reading, let me be so bold. I think my pronunciation, Shinola.
Uh-huh.
I read it, actually. Of course, now I recognize the term, but I was also thinking about, because I went to the trouble of looking this up, and the first thing I saw, of course, was Shinola as a watch company, a very high-end watch company. And I assumed that actually that might be part of the part of what's going on here. But, of course, the main thing clearly has to do with this well-known phrase or saying, which I, in fact, just forgot about for a moment.
I'm interested in that. I didn't know that. But I think that actually the political subtext of this poem is very apposite in our current moment, because it's really, this is, the subtext here is the decision to go into Iraq and the kinds of debates there were about it that everyone was obsessed by. There was this kind of neocon idea that we were going to save the world for democracy by toppling Saddam Hussein. You heard what Fred said about that in his poem. All that is here in the poem.
As a poet, but also as an editor, do you expect to see a lot more of what we would think of in general terms as political poetry over the next year or two?
I think that I expect there to be a lot of stock taking, and yes, I think probably most of it won't be terribly thought through, or it'll be emotional rather than considered.
But, well, most of it isn't thought through, no matter what its subject is. really, let's face it; it's very hard for all of us. But I think it's likely that there will be more references to current affairs, let's call them.
Yes, more problems for you as an editor.
And more for you. Let's hear this lunch poem for FS.
Lunch poem for FS. The dirty sunlight in the clerestory windows of our faux Parisian lair lends a streaky, half-forgiving glow to yet another summit with no purpose. Duck and iron Pinot Noir and double decaf espresso. Sheer necessities for urban inmates who still keep the faith with a wan cerise velvet banquette, an eye-level mirror lit with faces a John the Baptist Puritan might judge corrupt with too much liquid happiness. But it is happiness to lounge in semi-silence while the day downshifts and natter on about the shit that passes for Shinola, but we know is only sauce for the gander. It's not that we're against the war. We're against them, the boobs, the pimps, the know-it-alls, the true believers, everyone who isn't here awash in downtown gold, inhaling the exhaust of Burgundy. Loafing, gloating, having it our way, Friday afternoon at Montrachet.
With that beautiful closing couplet, putting the lid on it.
there are a lot of Seidelian things in here, and the couplet is probably one of them. But I noticed Clear Story, he stole that from me. So maybe, I don't know which poem came first, but I think mine did, actually.
Let me ask you a question, which may seem a bit odd. Did anything else strike you as you reread the poem there? Anything that came to the fore? Anything because at this stage, actually, you, of course, are really just another reader of the poem.
Yes, yes. What I feel reading this poem again is how intensely it reminds me of a period in New York life, in our political life, in that, you know, is past. It has a pastness to it. It has that awash in downtown gold quality. I mean, I'm actually someone who I have a kind of nostalgia for restaurants that have passed. They represent forms of attention, forms of social life that are codified in their way of being. And when they go, that's gone. That's part of the past. So poetry is so much about pastness, I think. Fred's poem certainly is. And this one is, too, in its own way.
It is, but it's also very much up to the moment. And that's one of the great things about both these poems, actually, that they resonate from moment to moment. They're not kind of consigned to their own pasts.
No, I think the lament for the past is a very presentist thing. And the ghost behind this poem, of course, is Frank O'Hara, because Frank O'Hara was the apologist for life. I can't remember that wonderful phrase about not regretting living. You know, that's the aegis under which this poem was conceived. And it's a New York poem. And New York is about life, I think.
Well, what a lovely note on which to end this New Yorker poetry podcast with Jonathan Galassi, who was reading his own poem there, Lunch Poem for F.S. And, of course, he also read F.S.'s poem, Frederick Seidel's poem, Poem by the Bridge at Ten Shin. And Jonathan Galassi, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Paul. It was great.
Poem by the Bridge at Ten Shin by Frederick Seidel and Lunch Poem for F.S. by Jonathan Galassi may be found on newyorker.com. Frederick Seidel's latest book of poems, Widening Income Inequality, was published earlier this year, and Jonathan Galassi's most recent collection is Left-Handed. Thank you so much for being with us today. Until soon, bye-bye.
You can subscribe to this podcast and other free New Yorker podcasts in the iTunes Store. You can hear more poetry read by the authors in newyorker.com and on the digital edition for tablets and phones at no extra charge from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Pintigree Ferryman from the album The Highlander's Farewell by Alastair Fraser and Natalie Ross from Colburnie Records. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast was produced by Jill Duboff and Alex Barron of NewYorker.com with help from Elizabeth Dennison.
I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast, a weekly television podcast that obsesses over all things TV.
Chris, Hillary, and I are at your service to recap and analyze the best that's out there and what you should be watching.
Plus, we're talking to the stars and showrunners about how exactly it all got made.
New episodes of Still Watching drop weekly wherever you listen to podcasts.